Welcome to Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the best NPR arts and culture stories. I am Netta Ulibi, NPR arts reporter.
And I'm Bob Mondello, film critic for All Things Considered.
You can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
award-winning actress Ellen Burstyn punches up the arrival of a long-shelved screenplay by Tennessee Williams.
We remember Eunice Johnson, an iconic figure in the world of fashion and African-American philanthropy.
And George Lucas returns with his latest blockbuster project, a book about movies.
But first,
around the world, people have spent more than $1 billion to see the 3D extravaganza Avatar. Meanwhile, the number one single on the Billboard Hot 100 right now, TikTok by Kesha. Netta, you recently got together with Zoe Chace to talk about what these two hits have in common. They are both totally derivative.
Okay, Zoe, when I saw Avatar, I was overwhelmed by how everything in the story has been in some other movie. Every other movie.
You are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora.
The Wizard of Oz, The Last of the Mohicans.
You know, Pocahontas had the Tree of Life, just like Avatar.
Right.
And the movie is just the ultimate mashup of colonialist fantasies that we've all seen, like The Last Samurai, Lawrence of Arabia.
Outsider wants to be the natives.
To become Aronyu, hunter, you must choose your own Ikran, and he must choose you.
When?
When you are ready.
Outsider wants to save the natives.
Outsider becomes king of the natives. Dances with wolves.
I'd never really known who John Dunbar was. Perhaps the name itself had no meaning. But as I heard my Sioux name being called over and over, I knew for the first time who I really was.
So, Zoe, do you suppose that James Cameron was purposefully trying to reference all of these movies when he made Avatar?
One would hope so. Netta, there's a song at the top of the pop charts right now, and it's called TikTok, and it's also incredibly derivative of basically every major theme that's ever run through pop music ever. Don't stop, make it pop, DJ, blow my speakers up. Tonight, I'ma fight till we see the sunlight. The lyrics mean nothing, and the song is about nothing, and it's not actually a very good song, in my opinion, but it sounds enough like a good song so that you can't quite tell the difference.
You know, when you listen to that song, you can't help but notice how heavily produced it is.
I know. The producers took her voice and just ran it through over and over and over. And the production process is kind of the same with Avatar. You know, it's just laid on so thick, you can't help but think about how produced it is.
Yeah. Me up, you break me down, my heart it pounds, yeah, you got. What's the singer's name again?
It's Kesha, and yes, that is spelled K to the E to the dollar sign to the H to the A.
She spells her name with a dollar sign?
Yeah.
When you channel and put together so many pop, cultural, and hip-hop memes, but you don't have a real story to tell, you kind of got nothing, which is why Avatar is an unbelievably brilliant picture to look at, but the story just doesn't match the visuals in terms of the sophistication. And, you know, if it did, it would be best picture.
And that's exactly what you hope for in a situation like this, with a movie like Avatar that has so much behind it, or in TikTok, which everybody is listening to, is that some genius producer has created this montage of tropes next to each other, like a bunch of movie scripts in a blender, to make a larger point. But if you're just employing a bunch of tired old tropes and you don't have a smart point to make about it, then you're just tired.
You know what? At least they're provoking us and probably tons and tons of other people to have a conversation.
I'm Zoe Chase.
I'm Netta Ulibi, NPR News. Don't stop,
make it pop. And you guys should absolutely be film critics. That is great.
Well, I just want to say that Zoe Chace is a young producer at National Public Radio.
Yeah, she's great.
I don't know how old she is, but she's probably in her early 20s.
Yeah.
And she spent a little time working at the arts desk, and she was so sensational that that our editor said, well, you know, we've got to get her on the air, and thank goodness for that.
Yeah, no, she's really wonderful. And those observations are absolutely dead on. They're just exactly right.
Although I also want to give a shout out to our producer, Michael Katz, if he was listening to this and said, Avatar is the auto-tune of movies. That should have been in the piece.
That's very nice.
Well, let's move to another more complicated female character. Tennessee Williams has written plenty of them. From Blanche DuBois to Maggie the Cat, he's created women tortured by the desire for freedom, but trapped by the social cruelties of their time. Tennessee Williams wrote a screenplay that sat on the shelf for decades, but now it's a movie, starring Ellen Burstyn. She plays one of those sad Williams women. When you first meet her, Miss Addie, she's lying in an upstairs bedroom, paralyzed by a series of strokes. She summons up another free spirit, played by the young actress Bryce Dallas Howard, who remembers her as a woman who'd escaped.
She said you wrote travel books.
My base was Hong Kong. There's much tolerance there. And here?
I would say none at all.
Yes. So I elected to spend my life in the tolerant Orient. But things that one elects are often circumvented by others.
My God. How, putting circumvented. Into, she's wonderful. That's so Tennessee Williams.
Burstyn appeared on Talk of the Nation and spoke with Neil Conan about the film.
And first, you get a script, you look at the author line, and it says Tennessee Williams. It's got to do a double take there.
Yes, I did. Well, I had heard about it first, of course, before I read the script. And I read it, and it was an intriguing character. And then I spoke to the director who came out to my house, and we met, and I was so impressed with her because she was an actress, Jodi Markell, and she, in her research, had discovered this unproduced Tennessee Williams screenplay, and she decided she wanted to direct it. So she found a producer who raised the money and actually was going into production. So I was very enthusiastic about her creative way she had brought this to fruition. So I climbed aboard, and I'm glad I did because I had never played a Tennessee Williams character professionally. I'd worked on a couple at the Actors Studio, but not professionally. As a matter of fact, now that I think about it, I auditioned for the Actors Studio playing Maggie the Cat.
Quite some time ago.
Yeah. And then late in Tennessee's career, he sent me a play he wanted me to do, but it wasn't one of his best plays, and I was very booked at the time, so I didn't do it. And then later, I realized I had missed an opportunity to create a Tennessee Williams character. So when this came along, I thought, oh, good. I thought I'd missed my chance, but here's a second chance. So I was very glad to do it.
To create a Tennessee Williams character. When is his name on the screenplay, do you ever say, you know, could I change that line just a little bit?
it didn't occur to me, no. And there was nothing about any of the lines that I would want to change. He had such a beautiful lyric gift that the lines just come out easily.
Why is it that something like this sits on a shelf for all those years?
Well, it's hard to answer. You know, Tennessee wrote all the time. He would go back over things and redo them, and he would write something as a one-act play, and then later he'd redo it as a three-act play. And it just may be that he found another way to explore whatever it is he was looking at in this play in something else, so he didn't feel a need to go back over it. You know, I always feel these lost female characters that he created were his own feminine side that he had to keep hidden, you know, because at that time it was not so easily to be open about being gay.
No.
So we all benefited from his suppressed femininity.
I think she's probably right about that, that we've benefited, although not so much in this particular show. This is real second level Tennessee Williams, and it was a very frustrating piece to look at when I saw it. It's you hear about this thing coming out, the loss of a teardrop diamond, and you think, oh well, that's a wonderful Tennessee Williams title, and when you see where it's going, it sounds like it's going to be kind of great too. But it's like every cliche from every Tennessee Williams play is packed into this one, and you feel like you've seen all of it before. And Ellen Burstyn, when she comes along, she's a fairly minor character. is wonderful in it. And you think, oh, well, if it was all like that, it would be great.
But some it just screenplays sort of should be left on the shelf.
Yeah, I think that's true. And if Tennessee Williams is not the normal path for Hollywood stardom these days, the road to success in Hollywood also does not normally lead through Harvard Medical School. There are exceptions, as we established this past week, and Valerie Weiss hopes to be one of them. After earning a Ph.D. from Harvard, she's left the lab for a different career. NPR's Joe Palca has her story.
When she was in graduate school, Valerie Weiss studied an enzyme called arginine methyl transferase. Never mind what that does, just understand that it's important in cells. Weiss was trying to figure out the enzyme's three-dimensional shape.
The idea is that how something is shaped has a huge effect on its function, because really molecules are just kind of like Legos fitting together, interacting, and then, you know, chemistry happens and the molecules change.
She gave up science because she had a career itch she needed to scratch. Weiss says science tends to be very specialized these days, and her interests are more eclectic.
At the same time that I was interested in science, I was really interested in theater. And I think for the same reason, just why do people relate to each other the way they do? Why is the world the way it is? I think I like asking that question on every level.
All right, here we go. Ready, ready?
Weiss and her crew have taken over a lab at Xencor, a biotech company in Monrovia, California.
Super far off for what? Kelly's going to bring it right over to you right now. Right, Kelly?
Strong lights are everywhere. Electric cables snake across the floor.
Quiet, please.
Weiss and her cameraman, Jamie Ehrman, confer about the best angle for the next scene.
Okay, guys.
Weiss is producer, writer, and director of Losing Control. They're shooting a key scene, and there have been a lot of takes. Now they're ready to try again.
Weiss, out quiet, please.
Action. Oh, sorry.
Weiss jumps the gun a bit. Then it is time.
Action!
Weiss asked me not to record while they were shooting. As I said, this is a key scene. She doesn't want to give anything away. Science doesn't show up in a lot of films, not real science anyway. Valerie Weiss wants to change that.
Why not science? It is fun, it is sexy, and, you know, it's a really rich, untapped area that I'm excited to explore.
And maybe show that scientists are smart people with problems and ideas and dreams, just like everyone else. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Well, we're going to go right now from the hopes and dreams of a former scientist to the hopes and dreams of a community. The Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture is finally open, but only on the internet. The physical building won't be done for at least 5 years. In the meantime, founding director Lonnie Bunch is scouring the country from antique shows to shops to people's basements, and he's looking for artifacts that tell the story of Black America. Guy Raz recently spoke to Bunch and asked him about the process of opening a museum of this scale.
It is clearly something not for the faint of heart. Mm. You start like you'd start almost a writing project. What are the stories you really think you have to tell? What do you want to do that differentiates that museum from any other museum of its type in the country and in the world? And then how do you really think about what a national museum should do?
What about the actual physical artifacts? I mean, there are so many museums of American history all across the country, and presumably many of these museums have artifacts that would be of interest to your museum. I mean, artifacts that are important to African-American history.
Well, if you said to me, what is the thing that worried me most going into this job? Wasn't raising money, wasn't building the building, it was building the collections. Mm. I knew that there were some things, but even if I went through the entire Smithsonian, it would only give me 20% of what I needed. Mm. And as I looked around the country, while there were places that had materials and objects we could use, that to be able to tell a comprehensive story, a lot of that wasn't there. One of the things we did was we created a program called Saving Our African American Treasures. And really, the goal was to help preserve things. So we put together a plan where we brought in conservators and preservation experts from the Smithsonian and the local communities. And we said, listen, we're coming to your town, so we want to do like an antique roadshow.
What are some of the things that you found?
I'll tell you, in Chicago, what we found was a woman came in and said, you know, I've got a Pullman Porter's hat. Most Pullman Porter hats are blue or gray. She had one that was a white leather hat, which meant that it was really used by the sort of leader of the Pullman Porters whenever they were doing something like servicing presidents or big vice presidents.
Oh, wow.
So it was a really rare thing. And I had only seen it in photographs. So to have it brought right in front of you, I immediately said, what are you going to do with that? And she said, I think this ought to go to the Smithsonian. And I said, I couldn't agree with you more.
Lonnie Bunch, tell us a little bit about what we could expect to see in the museum.
Well, one of the things that's important to me is to craft a museum that, on the one hand, is a place that helps you remember the African-American experience, remember the names you think you know, the Martin Luther Kings, the Sojourner Truths, but to really understand those stories that you don't know, to really understand what it was like to be an enslaved woman, or to really understand what it meant for a family to leave Mississippi to the south side of Chicago in 1970.
There have been some African-American history museums that have had trouble keeping their doors open. How confident are you that you can do this?
I've been struck by the number of average people who want to give to this museum. And the best way to sum that up is I was in Austin, Texas. I went to get my shoe shine, and it was an old black man. He's shining my shoes. He looks up and he says, are you that Washington, you know, museum guy on TV? Hmm. And I said, yes. He doesn't say a word. So he finishes shining my shoes. I reach in my pocket. I give him $6. And he says, keep the money for the museum. Hmm. Now, I got to be honest. I said, come on. You know, in my mind, I'm thinking, this is a shoeshine guy. He needs this money. So I push it back to him. And he says to me, keep this money because if you do this museum right, my grandchildren will finally understand what I did to life and what life did to me.
Oh, that was such a great ending thing.
And it's hard to come out of. Nowadays, it's not unusual to see black women walking the fashion runways in Paris, New York, or Milan. But before Naomi or Iman were household names, black women modeled for other black women in places like Detroit, St. Louis, or Jackson, Mississippi. That's thanks to the Ebony Fashion Fair, which set the pace for black fashion for half a century. The fair was the brainchild of Eunice Johnson, who died recently at the age of 93. In addition to founding Fashion Fair, Eunice Johnson helped start a line of cosmetics for women of color who could not find lipstick or foundation that matched their skin. Andre Leon Talley, the editor-at-large for Vogue magazine, spoke to NPR's Michelle Norris about the legacy of Eunice Johnson.
I can only imagine in the early days they were the most exciting moments in the annual social schedule of a community of women, be they women from the parlor maids to the poshest society, woman or sorority sister. And it would be a social event as well as a learning curve for fashion. Mrs. Johnson was hands on everything. I worked with her. I remember traveling with her to Paris, to Florence, to Milan, selecting the designs that she would showcase in a fashion fair.
Now, I understand in the early days, some of the designers did not want to sell their wares to her.
That is true. But then, you know, increasingly, as people became more aware, particularly in the 60s, of the importance of the show, she had so much clout due to the passion of her vision, it just became a phenomenon that people had to embrace.
Mr. Talley, I have to ask you about Eunice Johnson's Fashion Fair line of cosmetics.
Yes.
There was a time when, no matter where you were, if you went to a department store, there would always be a little bit of buzz at a certain space.
Yes.
At the cosmetic counter with
Yes.
people, you know, always seemed to be a throng of people around that sort of pink Fashion Fair
Yes.
counter.
Yes.
What did that mean for women who lived in communities where it was hard for them to find makeup that
matched
their skin color?
Well, it just meant that this was a lady who was thinking about their needs. It was Mrs. Johnson, smart enough to take color and translate it to the needs of women of many hues. So when she did those coppery hues or those patinated bronzes or those bright, bright colors that once were very much part of the world of fashion when Yves Saint Laurent was making a lipstick that was so cyclamen, fuchsia, pink hot, bright fuchsia orange red that everyone clamored for it, Mrs. Johnson translated that for the black woman.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
By creating the Star Wars movies, George Lucas launched a franchise that had an enormous impact on pop culture and on Hollywood marketing. And the eye-popping work of Industrial Light and Magic, his effects production house, has done the same thing for movie technology. Lucas's newest project, though, is a book. George Lucas's Blockbusting, a behind-the-scenes Hollywood history featuring the 300 films from the beginning of the cinema to 2005 that Lucas considers the most timeless and significant. Fresh Air's David Bianculli talked with Lucas about how movie-making costs have changed since the days of American Graffiti, and also about the communal experience of seeing movies in the theater.
The audience experience of a blockbuster, I'm not talking about the wider definition that you've done in the book, but the sort of thing that we think of where they make tons of money, they're very big spectacle films. I think of like Jaws, where I sat in the back of an audience once and saw everybody kicking at the same time to avoid being slid down like Quint in the shark's mouth, or going up the stairs of The Exorcist and everybody screaming at once. How important is that communal viewing experience as we move forward?
I think that is very, very important, and I think that's the key to why movie theaters and the movie-going experience in a theater will never die. I always tell people, I say, look, as long as Green Bay Packer fans go in the 70 below zero weather in the snow to watch a game they can't actually see because they all want to be together and scream together and have a good time together, the movie industry is safe. And there will always be movie theaters. There'll always be people that want that social experience because people, human beings, are a social animal. And they will want something like the opera, like the ballet, you know, they will want to go and have this communal motion picture experience, or like plays and Broadway shows. So I don't think that's ever going to go away. And I think in the end, the movie theaters are going to become more accommodating to that idea that it needs to be a special experience, a special communal experience, which means better quality theaters, bigger screens, more amenities, so that it's a real experience.
Does it necessarily mean more spectacle, or would there still be room for an American Graffiti along with a Star Wars?
I have a feeling that the American Graffitis are going to probably go by the wayside in terms of theatrical release. I think they're going to go directly to pay-per-view, you know, which is sort of internet-based distribution.
Boy, I hope he's wrong about that.
That's a bummer.
Yeah. And it would leave me reviewing nothing but these big spectacles, which would drive me crazy.
And we'd have to stick pay-per-view into the NPR arts budget.
Oh, dear.
That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Bob Mondello.
And I'm Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.